What happens when we face difficult conversations? These conversations can heal. They can foster forgiveness. They can inspire and change perspective. Lean into these stories and discussions. I think both our guests and our listeners will find value in them. And selfishly, I know I will too. Well, welcome everybody to this latest episode of Lean In with Dr. Jibran Pasha. I'm Jibran Pasha, and I'm here with a very special guest. Today we have Mr. Richard Rothstein, who is the author of what I would say for me is a foundational book for my understanding of how our cities became to look the way they do. The book is called The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. This book was long listed for the National Book Award for Nonfiction. It is a New York Times notable book, and I'm just really excited to be able to discuss this book with Mr. Rothstein. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on Lean In today.
Thank you for inviting me to do this with you.
Absolutely. So I believe your career was and expertise initially lied in education policy. This is obviously outside of that. What was your trigger for writing this book?
Oh, no, it's not outside of it at all. The biggest problem we face in American public education today is the achievement gap between Black and white students. On average, African-American children achieve at lower levels than white children. The reason they achieve at lower levels than white children is because they come to school with so many social and economic disadvantages. On average, I'm not talking about all, but particularly those who live in low-income segregated neighborhoods, they come to school with so many social and economic disadvantages that impede their ability to learn. And I began looking into this topic of residential segregation, and I realized that we couldn't solve our school problems so long as the schools were segregated, and the schools were segregated because the neighborhoods in which they located are segregated. So I began looking at the residential segregation as an educational problem. I didn't know much about housing. And of course, in the last 10 years or so, I've shifted my focus from education to housing policy. But it all began with education.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting how all of these things are interrelated. I mean, my area of interest is social determinants of health. And we know, just kind of as you alluded to, that education is tied to health, right? Where you live and grow up is tied to health. Your income is all tied to health. And you're absolutely right. This is all interrelated. Why do you feel like this has not gotten the attention? There seems to be kind of a lack of public outrage, given the fact that our communities all across the country still remain segregated in the way that they do.
Well, I think it's gotten a great deal of attention. We're having a more accurate and passionate discussion about the legacies of slavery and Jim Crow than we ever had before in American history, ever. We had 20 million Americans participate in Black Lives Matter demonstrations in 2020. So it's not that it's not getting a lot of attention. What it hasn't gotten yet is organization. We had a civil rights movement in the 1960s and 50s that mobilized young people in particular, but older ones as well, to take action to redress segregation. And that's what is necessary at this point when it comes to residential segregation. It's much harder to deal with than lunch counter segregation. You pass an ordinance prohibiting segregation in restaurants, the next day you can go to any restaurant. You pass an ordinance prohibiting segregation in neighborhoods, the next day things wouldn't look much different. So what we need is organization, a new civil rights movement that is going to build upon the attention that the history of slavery and Jim Crow has gotten and create organizational action to redress it.
And you talk a lot about the kind of the constitutional arguments for working to undo the segregation that still exists. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Well, sure. The federal government, as well as state and local governments, had racially explicit policies in the 20th century designed to create segregation and enforce it where it already existed, perpetuate it. In my book, The Color of Law, I talk particularly about the program of the Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administration in the immediate post-World War II period to suburbanize the entire white working class population. into single-family homes in all white suburbs. We weren't a suburban country at that time. Most whites and blacks were living in urban areas. We were a manufacturing economy. The factories needed to be located near deep water ports and railroad terminals to get their parts and ship their final products. And most workers didn't have automobiles, so they had to live in accessible distances. There were some streetcars available to take them to work. The Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administration embarked on a program after World War II to suburbanize that entire white working class population into single-family homes in all white suburbs. It was a racially explicit program. I write in the book about one in particular, Levittown, east of New York City. This was the biggest one, but they exist in every metropolitan area of this country, everyone. Federally subsidized subdivisions for whites only. William Levitt, the developer of Levittown, could never have built that project on his own. 17,000 homes in one place, an enormous undertaking. No bank would be crazy enough to lend them money to buy the land and build the homes on that land that he bought east of New York City. They thought it was a crazy idea. We weren't a suburban country at that time. They thought nobody was going to live in these places. The only way that Levitt could assemble the capital to build these homes by going to the Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administration, getting a federal bank guarantee for his loans. In order to get that federal bank guarantee, he had to commit never to sell a home to an African-American. Federal Housing Administration even required him and developers all over the country who created these suburbs to place a clause in the deeds of their homes prohibiting resale to African-Americans or rental to African-Americans. This was a racially explicit policy on the part of the federal government. It wasn't the action of rogue bureaucrats. The Federal Housing Administration published a manual for appraisers all over the country whose job it was to evaluate the applications of developers for suburban communities, for subdivisions. The manual said explicitly that you couldn't approve a recommendation for a federal bank guarantee for a subdivision that was not going to be exclusively white. The manual went so far as to say that you couldn't even approve a federal bank guarantee for a loan to a developer of an all-white project if it was going to be located near where African Americans were living. Because in the words of the manual, that would, quote, create the risk of infiltration by inharmonious racial groups. That's what the federal policy manual said. In my book, The Color of Law, I have a photograph of a six-foot-high, half-mile-long concrete wall. The developer in the Detroit area was required by the Federal Housing Administration to construct to separate his all-white project from a nearby black neighborhood as a condition of getting a federal bank guarantee. So this policy of the Federal Housing Administration, there were many, many other, by the way, federal housing policies, as well as state and local ones that were racially explicit, as this one was. But this determines the racial landscape of today. We passed the Fair Housing Act that in 1968 that said, okay, African Americans, you're now permitted to buy homes in these subdivisions, but the subdivisions are no longer affordable to working class families of either race. The white families who moved into those suburbs gained wealth from the appreciation and the value of their homes. They spent that wealth to send their children to college, to take care of maybe temporary emergencies like unemployment, short-term, but to subsidize their retirements and to bequeath wealth to their children and grandchildren, who then had down payments for their own homes, all from the appreciation and the value of these homes from which African Americans were excluded. The result is that today, African American family incomes are about 60% of white family incomes, 60%. African-American household wealth is about 5% of white household wealth. And that enormous disparity that underlies so much of our racial inequality today is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that was practiced in the mid-20th century. It's never been remedied, that we've never accepted an obligation to remedy.
In your book, The Color of Law, you talked a bit about the role of public housing and how we see public housing today and how that looks much different than the public housing of decades ago. Could you talk to us a bit about how public housing was originated and its role in the segregation of our country?
Sure. This is another example of an explicit federal policy to segregate our cities. Public housing began in the New Deal during the Depression, the Roosevelt administration in the 1930s. It was not for poor people. We think of public housing today as a place where poor people live. It was not for the poor. And if you have a copy of my book, The Color of Law, you'll see that the frontispiece, the photograph, is of Franklin Roosevelt giving the keys to the 100,000th family to get public housing during the New Deal program. The crowd surrounding the family, as well as the family itself, are all obviously middle-class white families. That's who public housing was for. We had a 25% unemployment rate in the Depression. Public housing was not for that 25%. It was for the 75% who had jobs, but who couldn't find housing because there was so little construction activity going on in the Depression. Well, the federal government built, as I say, the first public housing in this country during this period, and it segregated it everywhere, creating segregation, sometimes where it hadn't previously existed. The great African-American poet, novelist, playwright, Langston Hughes, I'm sure you're familiar with him, he wrote in his autobiography, The Big C, that he grew up in an integrated downtown Cleveland neighborhood. That's not how we think of downtown Cleveland today. He said his best friend in high school was Polish. He said he dated a Jewish girl. It was an integrated high school in an integrated neighborhood. Public Works Administration, the first New Deal agency to build civilian public housing, went into that neighborhood, demolished some existing housing, and created two separate projects, one for whites, one for African Americans, creating segregation where it hadn't previously existed. And this policy was followed all over the country. Now, how did it become the kind of public housing we know today? Well, we made a terrible mistake. It's a mistake we're duplicating today. Public housing officials, well-intentioned, but misguided, said that, well, you know, there's such an enormous housing shortage in this country. The people who are most desperate, the poorest people, should get priority for the public housing that exists. And middle-class families who were living in public housing were evicted in order to make room for the poor soon. The only people left in public housing were poor people. By the way, when public housing started, I mentioned for those middle-class families, it wasn't subsidized. People were paying the full cost of the housing and their rent. It was built by the government. It was public housing, but it was rented to people at market rents. Well, once they evicted all the middle-class people, they had to subsidize those who remained. Once they subsidized it, they stopped maintaining it well. There was no longer a political constituency for maintaining the quality of public housing. It became a place where we concentrated poor people, disastrous places, instead of mixed-income, healthy communities. So the history of public housing is a lesson for us about how we, well-intentioned, made that mistake, but we're making the same mistake now. We're now building low-income housing that concentrates low-income families in single projects, much as we did in the 1940s and 50s, instead of building mixed-income housing. There's no doubt that we face the same dilemma. There are limited funds. Poor people need the housing more, but we pay an enormous, enormous social price for concentrating the poor in single projects where they are isolated from the rest of our community.
So you talked about a couple of the federal programs. Are there other, you know, federal, state, local programs that you thought were quite problematic in this whole scheme?
Well, in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and a little bit into the 70s even, police protected violence at the local level drove African Americans out of homes that they had legitimately purchased or rented in white neighborhoods. This was an unconstitutional policy on the part of state and local governments. The police sometimes even organized and led the mobs that engaged in this violence against African American residents. In my book, I talk about an instance in Louisville, Kentucky, where an angry white mob surrounded a home that had been purchased by an African American in a previously all-white suburban neighborhood. They threw rocks through the windows. The police made no effort to stop it. They dynamited and firebombed the home. Police made no effort to stop that. But when the riot was all over, the state of Kentucky arrested, tried, convicted, and jailed with a 15-year sentence the white homeowner for sedition, for having sold a home to a black family in a white neighborhood. I looked into this further. And I found there were hundreds and hundreds of cases. I'm not exaggerating, hundreds and hundreds of cases of police protected, sometimes police led and organized mob violence to drive African Americans out of homes in white neighborhoods. This was a powerful, powerful impetus to segregation. It not only segregated the families who were forced out of those neighborhoods, but of course it sent a message to other Black families not to dare try to live in healthier, well-resourced neighborhoods.
I believe it was in one of your lectures that I watched online, you talked about a Supreme Court ruling that upholds much of the issues that you talked about today based off the argument that this was not government-supported. And you kind of talked about how that was really what interests you and maybe led to you wanting to write this book.
Yes, well, it relates to the history that I just described to you about the state of Kentucky arresting, trying, and convicting a white homeowner. This was in Louisville, Kentucky. In 2007, the Supreme Court prohibited Louisville, in particular, from enacting a very, very token school desegregation plan. Louisville permitted parents to choose which school in the district they would attend, but if their choice was going to intensify segregation, it wouldn't be honored in favor of the choice of a family that wouldn't do so. So if you had an all-white, a mostly white school, and both a Black and a white child applied for one of the last remaining places, the Black child would be given some preference, a very, very trivial program. But the Supreme Court denounced it, said you couldn't do such a thing. The Supreme Court said that the reason you couldn't do such a thing, the reason it was unconstitutional to have this kind of desegregation policy is because the government had no involvement in the segregation of Louisville, Kentucky. It was all private bigotry, private discrimination, people wanting to live with each other, the same race, income differences. And the Supreme Court said if the government wasn't responsible, then it's unconstitutional for the government to fix it. And so it was after reading that Supreme Court decision and considering it in light of that incident I described that happened in Louisville, Kentucky, that I came to the conclusion that our myth of de facto segregation, just something that happened by accident, was just that, a myth, and that we had an unconstitutional system of racial segregation that we've never accepted an obligation to remedy, although under the Constitution, we are obligated to do it.
So what would you say would be a fair and just remedy or beginning to a fair and just remedy?
Well, there's no fair or just, single fair or just remedy. There are many, many things that we need to do in order to redress segregation. I can mention a few. At two extremes, perhaps at one extreme, is the suburbs that were created in an unconstitutional fashion by the federal government with subsidies to white homeowners that subsequently increased in value to the point that neither whites nor blacks can afford to purchase homes in them without down payment assistance from their parents, which whites are likely to have because their parents and grandparents lived in appreciating homes that African Americans are prohibited. So one policy we should adopt is the federal government should be buying up homes in those communities, those segregated white communities that it segregated, buying them up at market rates and reselling them at the deeply discounted rates to African Americans to help to remedy the unconstitutional segregation that the federal government had created. At the lower end of the economic scale, we have a number of programs that reinforce segregation today that need to be reformed. The biggest subsidy to low-income families is something called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, which is a subsidy to developers to build housing for low-income families. It reinforces segregation today because most developers choose to build low-income housing tax credit units in existing low-income segregated neighborhoods, reinforcing their segregation. Not all of them are like that, but most are. And that should be reformed. We should be placing a much higher priority in putting low-income housing tax credit units in higher opportunity neighborhoods where the residents will have access to better jobs and transportation and healthy food, clean air, schools that aren't overwhelmed by the social and economic problems of their children. We don't do it because many suburban communities have zoning ordinances that prohibit the construction of multi-unit projects. Another reason is that developers would rather place those projects in existing low-income neighborhoods. The land is cheaper there, It's easy to rent because eligible low-income families can move by the project and see a sign in the window for rent. And because the developer doesn't have to hold 100 community meetings in some suburbs explaining why he's bringing Black and brown people into their neighborhood. So for all these reasons, we place most of our low-income housing tax credit projects in existing low-income neighborhoods, reinforcing their segregation. We ought to change that policy. We ought to place a higher priority on placing those projects in higher opportunity communities. And many of them will be white, many of them will be suburban. That's the policy priority we should adopt. So there are, and in between those two, there are many, many other policies that we should follow and that give us the opportunity to begin to redress segregation.
Well, this is great. Is there anything else from your book that we haven't talked about that you want to mention before we let you get off to your next meeting?
Well, there's lots of stuff I haven't mentioned.
Yeah.
Why don't you pick something that interests you and we can talk about it.
So you mentioned a little bit about what I know as housing land covenants. And I actually have a coworker, my boss actually, who bought a property adjacent to his home and said, hey, Gibran, I want to show you this. And it was a land covenant from 1946 in Tulsa, right adjacent to Southern Hills Country Club, that said exactly what you alluded to, that this land should never be occupied or owned or rented to anyone known as Negroes. And it's my understanding that these covenants exist all over the country. And it sounds like the government had a huge role in that, and it has become kind of commonplace to uncover these.
Sure. Once you create a deed for a piece of property, you can't change it. So once it's there, it's no longer enforceable. Well, you can't change it. You can't change a deed with a covenant like that any more than you can get up in the morning and say, I'm going to change my property line. You know, a deed is a deed. But it's unenforceable now. But it was enforceable up until the mid-1950s in some respects, and they exist everywhere, and they're one way of educating people about how segregation was created. As I mentioned earlier, the government required those covenants to be placed in deeds in many of the developments that it subsidized. Even if it didn't require it, the only way they could be enforced is by courts, public courts, state and local, and even federal courts, ordering the eviction of African Americans who may have bought homes in that had those kinds of deeds. That enforcement by federal courts and state and local courts was a violation of the Constitution. So there's a lot of movement around the country to try to remove those deeds from those clauses from deeds. As I say, you can't remove them, but it would be a better idea to be proactive and staple a statement on top of that deed saying that this deed includes an unconscionable restriction, and we want to assert that we welcome people of all races and ethnicities into our community and are ashamed that our community once thought it acceptable to exclude them. That would be something you could do with the deed rather than going to a fruitless effort to try to remove it, because it can't be removed.
Well, Mr. Rothstein, I want to, again, thank you for your time today. This book it's been an important book for me, and I know it's been an important book for a lot of people. And thank you for your work and all of your efforts. We look forward to speaking with you again in the future, hopefully. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Let me know your thoughts about this episode. I'm easy to reach on Twitter at Gibran Pasha, on Instagram at What Medicine Did, and on UnlockingImplicitBias.com. Thanks for leaning in with me.